Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Gulf Coast Sunday morning. A little fog, a little rain, a little warm temperatures, and it's New Year's. You know, there's something about New Year's. It makes me think about auld lang syne, about those old times gone. Makes me think about what life was like in the old South. You know the old South. So I'm thinking about life in the South about, 10,000 years ago. How's that for Old South? It's a good time to think about it. I do think about what life was like in Mobile about 10,000 years ago. Very interesting. So my guess is, sitting here thinking about this coming up on New Year's Eve, is that there was a band of folks looking for a good place to live, a good place to make a living, someplace maybe a little bit warmer. You know, it had been within their memory 18,000 years ago, about the time that people first started coming into the onto this continent, that it was pretty cold all the time. Well, that's not true. It was chilly. Certainly, we didn't have the warm temperatures like we do now. But the Gulf Coast would have been a refuge, and it would have been a place that people would have recognized, because this Gulf has been around for a long time. It's like a big, it's like this big heater down there that heats up the lower part of the United States. It's a big flywheel, if you will, if you're a physics kind of guy, that holds on to energy and then re-releases it during cold periods. And so it's a very interesting thing. And people would recognize, you know, there was this place in people's memories, and they could come back to, and we need to come back to this place called the Gulf. And people were, I don't know how many folks there were, but I imagine... You know, I imagine a band of folks, community of folks, relatives and cousins and friends, maybe 50 people, maybe 60 people, traveling together, looking for a place to live. And they come eventually to this big valley. In those days, you know, in those days, 10,000 years ago, these people were coming into the Mobile area, and they were living on the memory. They were looking for things. What were they looking for? Were they looking for deer? No, actually, I think they were looking for the last of the mastodons. Isn't that weird? They were looking for things like mastodons and maybe camels. We had these alpaca camel-like creatures that were common here with very long necks. Maybe they were looking for the last of the 12-foot sloths. Can you imagine? Raising up on their hind legs, getting into the trees. Or they were looking for maybe the last of the glyptodonts, which are basically... If you have to imagine a 6-foot-high armadillo. They were chasing these things. They were still around. They were still part of our world in those days. They were getting very rare. The buffalo were getting more rare, certainly in the east. But they were probably chasing them along the coastal valleys, chasing them down through what was then these big longleaf forests and oak hickory forests, down towards this big valley. And they come to this giant valley. Try to imagine that valley. It must have been magnificent. looking across, and you could see how rich that valley was, because it was this big river with lots of water, and you know, just pouring down out of the middle of this place that we now call Alabama. And that was the Alabama River, what we now call the Alabama River. And that big valley, full of forest, rich with forest, all kinds of oaks and hickories, probably the center of tree diversity, even with certain types of pines that we have, pines that we don't have, the uplands still with a good component of longleaf. Maybe even in those days, there was this thing called white pine, the southern white pine, and maybe even southern spruce, a true spruce that existed in the south, much like the spruces that exist in Mexico where the monarchs live. These things were still there, I think, maybe, remnants of them, in this deep valley. And they were standing on a hill, and I imagine that hill is about where, let's say where Brooklee is right now. Looking into this beautiful valley. That valley was Mobile Bay. And they followed that valley, climbed down those cliffs at Brooklee, down into that beautiful valley, and they followed the river of that valley as far out as they could. And they came to this last big, tall series of hills. I would guess it's about 40 miles south of Brooklee, maybe 50, 60 miles south of Brooklee. This last great series of hills. And from those hills, I'm sure they had longleaf on them. I'm sure the longleaf and the slash pine forest were all around in those valleys and on those hills, along with all of the beautiful oaks and hickories. And they could look down and they could see forest extending, but just, you know, the hills were so high that just at the edge of those hills, they could see what looked like a clearing, like an opening. It was the ocean. Way, way south of those hills. You know what those hills were? About 10,000 years ago. Not that long ago. When people first came to Mobile. That was Dauphin Island. Those were the hills of Dauphin Island. And the shoreline of Mobile Bay was, it was retreating very rapidly. It had been retreating for a long while. For about 6,000 years, that shoreline had begun moving northward. It had started out, follow me here, listen to me here, about 80 miles south of Dauphin Island. It was all forest there. It was cypress forest. It was delta. It was the delta we know now. It was much, much farther south, way out in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. But it had begun retreating, and now the delta was probably somewhere, just south of Dauphin Island. A great, huge, gigantic delta developing, and people were very impressed. And there was, and at the mouth of that delta were all of the oysters and the range of clams that people had been eating for years and years. They were all there in that delta. And they were looking for this place, but you know, they had a sense, gosh, things were changing, because things were beginning to change rapidly again. It was getting warmer, and maybe it was getting warmer fast enough that people could even notice. You know, people are funny that way. They have a hard time having memories of what things used to be like. People in those days would have had as hard a time seeing that climate was changing as people do now. Because they live year to year. They try to function year to year. But then they'd come back to the same places and they'd say, ooh, we're going to collect food here. And it wasn't right, because they'd missed the window. The seasons were all changed. The seasons were altered. 10,000 years ago, it's fun to think about what Mobile was like, what the South was like, because it may tell us a little bit about how we live now. and what we have to face in the future and how we adapt to it. Hey, give us a call this morning, 251-343-0106. It's New Year's.
I ain't gonna pick no peace, because everything's gonna fall. You gotta get down on your bended knees. I ain't gonna dig no more taters. I decline, I ain't gonna pick no peace, because everything's on the phone. You know you got to go. I get down on your bended knee.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Through the window, by the window, that is where all become tiptoe through the tulips with me.
Yeah, there you go. I just had to listen to that last little... Well, we have to do that once an hour. Maybe once every 2 hours. Not every week. Not every week do we hear him, but every now and then we do, just to remind us where we are. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Coming up on New Year's. If you've got garden questions, you feel free to give me a call this morning. I've already had a few texts come in. I don't want to help you win too many arguments, but yeah, that's called a gum tree. We'll call it a sweet gum tree is what I used to call it growing up. Timber people call it red gum because it has a beautiful wood, but that's sweet gum. Some people have a hard time telling sweet gum from maple, and it can be confusing, and I admit, you know, I've looked at a tree, I've looked at leaves quickly sometimes, and been confused myself. It can get confusing. But there's a difference between sweet gum and maples. Sweet gums have more of a star-like. They're more like a star. I don't know how to say that exactly, but do you see what I'm saying? They're more like a star. They have five lobes that are more like a hand spread wide, and more star-like. Maples don't look quite like a star. They look more like a maple. It's like the fingers of those lobes don't radiate quite the same way. And we have some great maples. Most of our maples are going to have much smaller leaves. That any maple that we have that has five lobes is going to have much smaller leaves than those sweet gums. The bark on that tree is also a dead giveaway. It's kind of a sweet gummy-like bark. And the branches look like sweet gum. And you may even see one of the other ways to tell, Rusty, you can tell when you're looking at a sweet gum and not a maple. Sweet gum often has those little wings, like little corky, well, I'll tell you what they used to call them. They called them corky excrescences. And I like to say that just out loud every now and then. Corky excrescences, which are these little, like little wings on the stem. You remember those? There are other trees that have that. Hackberry has it to some degree. Some elms have it. But a lot of sweet gums will have those little corky little things on some of the stems. And that's always a dead giveaway, too. But, yeah, that's definitely sweet gum, red gum. One of my favorite trees, particularly in fall. It's just one of those trees of the South. It doesn't get very far north. I'm always surprised that it doesn't because it's so common for us. But it doesn't. Hey, you know, I've been thinking about, it's New Year's, and I keep thinking about what life in Mobile was like in the old days, in the golden days, in the good old days, 10,000 years ago, when things were changing, much like they're changing now. maybe in kind of in the same direction and in the same way, maybe a little faster it's happening now, but things were changing. People were trying to adapt. People were trying to figure out where they were. And I keep imagining Dolphin Island, because in those days, 10,000 years ago, Mobile Bay was a big valley full of forests. This incredible forested area, and I can still see little remnants of what that forest was like. I know what that forest was like, because there are little tiny remnants that we haven't destroyed along Dog River. Just little tiny remnants with these trees that we normally associate with places much farther north, but all kinds of oak species, all kind of hickories, beautiful areas, very unusual areas right along the shoreline. Really interesting beech trees. You can imagine this deep, rich forest going all the way down Mobile Bay, out opening somewhere south of Dolphin Island, this big valley with all these trees, and the delta forming south of Dolphin Island. And Dolphin Island was this big line of hills. Not an island at all, but a big prominent. Big prominent area, big rise, sort of this last big rise before you descended into that plain that extended way out into the Gulf, probably still several miles out into the Gulf south of Dolphin Island, with full of forest and trees. And I imagine people living on those hills, and I think about, what did they eat? How did they live? What was life like for them? And it's interesting. You know, people ate corn. Well, no, they didn't eat corn. They had cornfields. No, they didn't have cornfields. Not in those days. And in fact, corn was kind of a relatively recent thing. It came to Alabama late. Long, 10,000 years after people, 15,000 years after people came to Alabama, finally, they discovered corn not too long ago. Maybe 1,500 years ago, a few hundred years ago, corn became big in Alabama. But it was a latecomer. It was a latecomer to Alabama. What were people eating? What were they growing? Did they have fields? I think they did. I think they did, but they were kind of funny. I think they gardened a different way than we garden now. We may talk a little bit about that today, thinking about what life was like in the Old South 10,000 years ago in Alabama. Can you imagine? That's what it's fun to do on New Year's. Think about what life was like before us, before our time. Hey, Errol, I'm listening. What's up?
Hello, Bill. Anyway, about 3 weeks ago, I planted some collard greens.
Yes.
And so I noticed just a few of the leaves are getting a little bit yellow. What would be the cause of that?
Well, it could be a lot of things. These are the outer leaves?
Yes, the outer leaves. Yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes this time of year, and particularly in these humid, cool days, I notice that there are some diseases that will often get to the outer leaves, particularly if the collards are planted pretty close together, and where the leaves touch or where they touch the ground, sometimes you'll get a little yellowing on the outer leaves. And the way I solve that problem is I don't eat the outer leaves. I give them to the chickens. It's usually not too big of a problem. I think they'll grow out of it. But the center of the plant's looking pretty good.
Yeah. The center looks fine.
Yeah. Then I wouldn't worry too much about that. It probably is a little bit about moist conditions and the right temperatures. And I noticed that on a lot of my cabbages, Chinese cabbages and regular cabbage and collards, that the leaves that are closest to the ground or that are closest to other plants, sometimes they'll turn yellow. But I think they'll be okay. And the regular leaves are probably going to be just fine. Are your, and I can't think of anything to tell you to worry about. Are the collards close together? Or are they, how close together are the collards?
I specifically planted them 18 inches apart, according to the package.
Yeah, they'll be fine. They'll be fine. I think you're good. Now, you know, there's one other thing, and we've had plenty of time. Is this new soil? Is this where you've tell me about your soil? Anything? Have you been planting collards in this place for a long time?
No. It's a raised flower bed, I guess, about maybe 6 inches, and
yeah.
I did grow some okras in there for the last 2 years, but I've never had collards in this ground.
Yeah, so that's fine. And tell me about the fertilizer you used. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, I have not put any fertilizer in it. There was some fertilizer in the container that it came with.
Yeah, so here's let me say this. I'm pushing up against break here, but let me just say, you need to fertilize. Let me make it simple, because right now it sounds like you're a little deficient in fertilizer. Use Miracle-Gro, and I don't usually like to use that because it's not efficient, it's not really great, but because I think your collards probably need a little bit of fertilizer at this point, let's use some Miracle-Gro. And you don't want to mix it up just real heavy. Make sure you don't use any more than what the package specifies. And go ahead and put a little bit of Miracle-Gro on those collards. Cause they do need some fertilizer, particularly in ground that you've farmed before, because those plants have taken most of the nutrients out of the soil. And, you know, they need a little bit of grease to keep the wheels running. And that's what these nutrients do. It's just grease to keep the wheels running so that they can convert sunlight into energy. But I think they've about run out of grease.
Okay.
So I think you probably need to add some. Now, long term, I would come up with an entirely different system for fertilizing those beds. But short term, I'm going to say that's what you need to do. And we'll come back. I'll come back after this break. And I'll tell you about what you can do long term to improve the soil in that bed.
Okay.
All right. Good.
That's fine. Yeah.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right. Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Let me finish, Errol. Let me just finish. You need a little bit of fertilizer for those beds. And I'm going to say, because you need it quickly and because it's winter, and for a lot of other reasons, I think the best thing to do at this point is to use Miracle-Gro. And it's not a great fertilizer. It's not an efficient fertilizer, but it's an okay fertilizer. And the formulation is good. I like the way they formulate it. It's good for seedlings. It's good for watering plants in containers. I highly recommend it for that. And it'll be good for your collards. But long term, you need to improve the soil in that bed. And let me tell you, you know, organic matter in our soils is very important. If you get a chance, it's really good to add some leaves, for example, or other things. Give those leaves a chance to break down this spring if you can idle those beds after you grow the collards. And let some leaves break down and improve the soil that way. That can make a big difference. You might need to add a little bit of lime to the soil as well. Not a lot. If you have fireplace ashes, that's even better. Fireplace ashes are one of the, particularly for the Gulf Coast, fireplace ashes are one of the unheralded garden amendments. I mean, I think it's after organic matter, which I stress over and over again is the most important thing. I think fireplace ashes are incredibly good for a lot of things. So if you can find some fireplace ashes that are just good, clean fireplace ashes where somebody's burned hickory or oak, not anything toxic, not treated wood or stuff like that. Don't put anything in there besides good, plain old wood. If you got fireplace ashes, that's really nice to add. And you can add, you can call me back and we talk about adding a few handfuls of that. But you need a little bit of that in there. And then you probably need a source of nitrogen in the long term too. And that's, it's easy to come by and you know, I use blood meal sometimes if I don't have other sources of nitrogen. Just add a little bit of blood meal to that. But there are many other sources. Cottonseed meal can work just fine. It can work just fine. Cottonseed meal is a good source of nitrogen for the long term as well. Not as hot as some others, but it's very safe and easy to use. So those are the things you need to do long term. And Errol, call me back next week when you have a chance to talk, when you're not headed to church, and we'll talk a little bit more about getting that bed prepared and what you want to get out of it and how we make those beds work here on the Gulf Coast. Vanna, you know, your question reminds me that I got another thing to say about satsumas, but throw your question at me. I'm listening.
Well, I had an exquisite picture of the lumpiest skin on a satsuma you've probably ever seen. And my friend brought me a box of satsumas, and many of them had this lumpy appearance. But I don't have an iPhone yet. That's my New Year's goal.
Oh,
but,
good.
They're just lumpy in appearance, and she doesn't spray them. The tree's about 25-plus years old. It was on her mother's property. And I said, let me try and see if Bill Finch can identify this. What in the world is it? They seem to be fine on the inside. They taste all right. I really wasn't afraid to eat them since she doesn't spray them. But
well, this is a real
lumpy.
It's a real interesting question. So, I've heard from several people this year, and this adds to the complexity of my answer, which is to say, I'm not sure, but I've heard from several people that they've had unusual fruit this year on their satsumas. Uh-huh. Some of them I think I can diagnose. I think I figured out some of the issues. You have to kind of listen. But since these are satsumas, and since they're very tasty on the inside, but lumpy on the outside, you know, I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. But sometimes when we get these dry summers, when there's a dry summer with sort of variations in rainfall, strong variations in rainfall, lots of sunlight, sometimes there's kind of a sun scald that develops, and rough, deep places that develop, I think it's got to do with this summer weather. My bet is that the ones that were the lumpiest were the ones on the sunny side of the tree. But we don't know since you didn't pick them.
Well, I can ask her, but that's interesting. Yeah. I'll tell her what you said.
Yeah,
but they are the strangest looking things. If there was an email I could possibly send this to eventually, you know, look at maybe at the Botanic Garden or something. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me
it's a picture is worth a thousand words, as they say, and this one, you won't believe it when you see it.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. And I would have to guess. Now, the other thing that can do it would be some injury to the fruit. And we've seen that happen sometimes with birds and bugs and other things that can cause injury to the fruit. But it would have to be a special kind of injury. And I'd have to think about a little bit about that. But I'm pretty sure that these conditions, and I'm going to spend a little more time thinking it. Here's yet another situation that I've got to think about. I'm pretty sure that this was a result of environmental conditions this year, mm-hmm. with a really dry period, an extended period of heat. Do you like the flavor of the satsumas, Vanna?
Oh, sure. They're fine. They're fine inside.
Yeah. Yeah, and so can you compare them to other satsumas you've had in years past? Do you think they're just as good?
Well, I must admit that the surface detracts, you know, you a little bit.
Oh, you're prejudiced
really
just because. Yeah.
It's really strange. Anyway, I'm very sorry I can't get this to you. I wish if there was a way, or later on, you know, even during the week, if I could send it somewhere, and you would see.
Yeah. Well, let me.
I'll tell you what. Well, maybe I could print it and mail it to you. Maybe.
Well, you could, but let's figure this out. I'm gonna
Probably weather related. I'll just tell her that for now.
I wish you could just send it.
No, I'm getting an iPhone.
Does your computer not allow you? You know, you can send
myself in the new year. I promise.
Yeah. So your computer wouldn't allow you to send to a cell phone number, right?
Well, my husband's daughter took the picture and sent it to my computer.
Oh, well, then all you need to do is get her to send that picture to
all right.
Get her to send the picture to the number you just called. If you'll just call her and tell her, send that picture to the number that you called. Just all she has to do is text it. And once you get your iPhone, you're going to see what I mean. But you just tell her to send that as a text to me, to this number, and I'll have it right away.
343-0106-250.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. I'll do that.
I'll have it right away. All right,
man. Thank you.
Good to hear. And I'll be thinking about these satsumas.
Okay. You'll laugh when you see it. Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye. Well, so... You know, I've had lots of questions about satsumas this year. I kind of thought we would. The lumpy ones are a little bit of a problem. Last week I had a call from someone, and I wish we could, you know, I've been thinking about it. The description that I had from that person leads me to believe there was a different issue. And let me tell you, a lot of people with ugly, dry satsuma fruit... Where in one place in the tree, and they have lots of good satsumas in other places, but this particular part of the tree has these lumpy, dry fruit that are consistently dry all inside the fruit, and it's all on one side of the tree. Let me tell you what happened. I've got to believe that is the result of rootstock getting out of control. It's not a real satsuma. It's the rootstock. So if you've got any questions about that, give me a call back and we can talk about it. But sometimes the rootstock, the thing that the satsuma is welded onto, the roots that the satsuma is welded onto about 6 inches above the ground, sometimes that rootstock begins to sort of take over on one side. And I can tell you how to fix that pretty easily. It's very easy to do. But I think that's been the problem. Now, this lumpy satsuma is another issue altogether, and we'll be thinking about it. Hey, we'll be back. Give us a call.
Sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played, waiting for the Alabama sun to go down to red dirt girls in a red dirt town, me and Lillian. Just across the line in a little southeast of Meridian.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain on my face. Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about satsumas, can we? And what happens, you know, one of the reasons, let me just kind of walk you through Satsuma fruit. One of the reasons I recommend people don't grow Satsumas, or don't, that's not what I mean to say. One of the things I recommend is I recommend that people not get their Satsumas to fruit, that they reduce fruiting on their Satsumas. Let me say it that way. The first 3 years, you don't want to grow your Satsumas expecting it to fruit in the first 3 years. And if it does develop fruit, I recommend you take it off. And you do that because you'll stress the tree. It's true. And the tree won't get well established. It's having fruit is a stressful thing. And your fruit tree is still a baby. You don't want it having fruit. You want it to get well established. And I don't care how old it was before you planted it. Once you planted it, it's got to get established. So you can call it a baby once you plant it. And it needs about 3 years. And for the first 2 years, really no fruit at all. But, you know, here's the other thing I say. The fruit that you get for the first 3 years is not going to be good fruit anyway. And this is true for any fruit-producing tree, perhaps except for a fig. It's not going to be that good. And what happens with that Satsuma fruit the first 3 years? Vanna, this may help you, may help your friend, may help other folks who've seen funky things going on with their fruit, is because there's not enough leaf cover, and the sun is very hot, that the fruit that's on the sunny side of the tree, well, which is all sides of the tree when there aren't many leaves, is not going to develop properly. It's going to get puffy. It's going to have little bumps and carbuncles on it. It's going to have lots of rag. And it's just going to get too hot. And that's one of the problems that people see when these young trees are trying to produce fruit. And it's because of heat and sunlight, and it just produces misshapen, thickened fruit with too much of that white, gooky rag stuff in there. And the fruit, it's like the peel doesn't even adhere to the fruit itself. That's what happens on young trees. And people ask me what to do about it. Well, don't pick fruit for the first 3 years. Just take it off when it's young, because it's not going to be very good in general. You might get lucky, but then you're going to stress the tree. But after about year 4, 5, and 6, it gets beyond those problems. If you've taken care of your tree, if it's growing well, doesn't have any of those problems, except we're seeing that problem this year. And I think I got a pretty good guess that it is the result of these extremely warm conditions and dry conditions all occurring at the same time, and putting some stress on those trees, leading to thickened fruit. It doesn't happen enough that the conditions we had this year don't happen enough that there's a good record of it. But I've seen evidence in the past. I've read about situations in the past where this has happened. So I'm guessing that it really was the extreme heat, the persistent heat this year that just went on and on and on, along with dry conditions. And that was the problem on those Satsumas. And not a lot you can do about it, is there? Not really. I mean, it's just, you know, it's the environment. It's what's been happening. So there it is. Somebody's asked, I got lots of text questions that I'm going to try to get to. What about pine ashes? We burn a lot of pine in a fire pit, but not much hardwood. You know, the pine ashes are a little different in composition than hardwood ashes, but they're still good. They're great. They're wonderful. So don't feel bad about using them. I think they're probably, I read the other day the difference in ashes from pine trees and hardwood trees, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but it's not a huge difference. You're still going to get good magnesium. You're still going to get good calcium. You're still going to get good potassium, all these wonderful things, and you're still going to change the pH of your soil. Maybe not as dramatically, but you're going to raise the pH of your soil, which we need to do a little bit here. It's important to do. I think those pine ashes should work really, really well. So let's see. I've got yeah, and David says you should play Tiny Tim one last time this year and dedicate it to Taxman. Taxman deserves better, of course. But Taxman was like all of us. We sort of tolerated Tiny Tim as part of our show, and I can't quite tell you how that got part of our show, but it's there. It's now part of it. Taxman, man, we miss him. We miss him every week. It's. I just really wish, you know, I wish we could hear from him. Thinking about losses in this past year, one of the great losses for our show is going to be the loss of Taxman this year. It is a good time to remember him. Dan is asking me about, have I ever heard of Debosha Benny? Yeah, Debosha Benny, if I'm not mistaken, Dan, and I'll have to remember all of these names, Debosha Benny is one of the earlier Satsumas. It's not the earliest. It's not one of the Wases that are particularly early, Okitsu Wasi or some of the others. But Debosha Benny is a little bit earlier. It would be a fun one to try. I think earlier is relative. You really, you know, some of the earlier Satsumas in a year where we get cool temperatures in September, those earlier Satsumas can do really, really well. But Debosha Benny is one of the ones that was trialed by John Olive. John may remember specifically how it worked out, but I'm pretty sure I remember it being one of the ones that was trialed, and it did fine. It did great. It's not one of the ones we focused on in the end, I think, but it's not a bad one. And if you have, if you can get hold of it, it could be a fun thing to try. So I'd try it and see how it goes. Stephanie has a question about something she planted under a live oak, and it looks to me, oh goodness gracious, it looks to me like Ugly Agnes, and we—that's a Tom Doddism. Tom the Third was where I first heard that. Maybe Tom borrowed it from somebody else, but Tom liked to call it Ugly Agnes. Ellie Agnes is the official name. Some people call it Autumn Olive or Russian Olive. They're slightly different things, but the names get all mixed up. But it is—it's not a true olive. It doesn't really produce fruit in our climate, and it becomes a big nuisance once it starts climbing like that. So what you have is an Ellie Agnes, E-L-E-A-G-N-U-S. Did I spell that right? Yeah. And we sort of remember how to spell it because we remember Tommy Dodd saying Ugly Agnes, which is an okay description once you see it starting to take off and become a real nightmare to manage, which it sounds like this one's beginning to do. Ugly Agnes, Ellie Agnes. Hope that helps Stephanie on that tree. You know, it's time for this show to conclude for this hour, but we're going to be back for another hour, so stay tuned. We're going to talk a little bit more about what the old South was like in Mobile. With the roses so red.